And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, new paradigms for a new world, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We stream live on the internet at richarddugan.com. We also archive all of our programs, including today's, no exception whatsoever. And my guest today is the author of Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions. Interesting. We're going to find out a little bit about what he means by productive obsessions. My guest is Eric Maisel. He's a PhD, and I thank you so much for joining us, and we have so many different things to talk about. Welcome to Tell Me Your Story.
Thanks, Richard. Great to be with you. I was just singing along with your theme music.
Well, my wife and I, a few years ago, we were driving through Ireland listening to Mary Black, and this song came up. She says, you know, you ought to use this for your radio program.
There you go. Maybe we can just have a sing-along.
I wouldn't. Hey, it's not a bad idea. I mean, you know, it beats Kumbaya, I got to tell you, by a long shot. Now, your latest work, if I'm correct, is Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions. And the first thing I'll take to task with you is this issue of obsessions. Don't we have enough obsessions already, Eric? It's just going crazy. What do you mean by obsessions?
We have plenty of bad obsessions, you bet. We have plenty of unproductive obsessions. I think the place to start is more than 100 years ago in clinical psychology, obsessions got defined as unwanted, intrusive thoughts, so all obsessions got labeled negative. And we haven't really been able to have smart conversations about positive or productive obsessions because all obsessions got labeled as negative. But I think our artists and writers and scientists have known for thousands of years that there are productive obsessions, namely that biting into something, paying attention to it, spending time, feeling the pressure of wanting to solve a problem, all of those things are good things. They're the way civilization moves forward. Unproductive obsessions are rooted in anxiety, and productive obsessions are rooted in our meaning-making needs.
Well, I think that it's time, as we have been discussing on this program over the last 3 years, time to redefine some of the words that we've been using or choose new words. When I refer to the conversation on death and dying, I don't use the words death and dying. I use the word transitioning, because death and dying are so negatively charged, and dying isn't necessarily a bad thing. We have fears around it, and that's what we try to get through.
You bet. I'm also very interested in language and how we use language. When I work with clients as a creativity coach and a meaning coach, and when I train coaches, we look at specific language all the time, especially the language of meaning, which is a difficult subject, but which we don't have a very good vocabulary around. So I entirely agree.
Well, you also, I mean, you're very prolific, both in fiction and nonfiction. You've written some journals, as well as what I find interesting is, if I'm reading this correctly, meditation decks. These are
I've done everything under the sun.
Everything.
That's right.
You've got an e-book.
Had a long career, and I've probably written 50 or so books and had 35 of them or so published.
Yeah.
Like every creative person, I have things that didn't work and things that did work. So I've done an awful lot of things over these last four decades.
And you focused a lot on writing, a lot of books dealing with writers and writing. And I know that that was one of the things early on in my career in interviewing people. The first best suggestion to a would-be writer is write.
That's still the first best suggestion. The second best suggestion, if you want one, is to have a morning writing practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems strange that that should be what I think is the second most important thing. But people don't make good use of their sleep thinking. By writing at other times of the day rather than the first thing in the morning, they're letting go of all the good thinking they've done during the night. And we dream during the night. We also think during the night.
Yeah, well, I had some weird thoughts a few nights back that I woke up and I said, that was too real. That was way too real, folks, I'm going to tell you. But what was interesting was the dream actually, as far as I could tell, and of course this would take us into a different direction as
mm-hmm.
well, but as far as I could tell, it took place in my this lifetime past, when I was in a different era. And yet it's like, but that didn't happen to me. And yet there I am in this dream, and it is real, and I wake up exhausted. And we have those from time to time. Well, I guarantee you that by the end of this program, I'm going to be anything but exhausted. I'm very excited to have you on the program. And we're going to continue here on Tell Me Your Story. My guest is Eric Maisel. He is the author of Brainstorm. And we're going to find out exactly what meteorologists have to say about brainstorms, what are the conditions, and if they are appropriate for us to conjure, how we can do just that. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
If you're looking for a general contractor to hang a door or build your multi-million dollar facility, talk to Armstrong Associates that specializes in both residential and commercial construction. I'm Steve Cushman, president of the Santa Barbara Region Chamber of Commerce. We're proud that Armstrong Associates, a five-time Builder of the Year award winner, was recently named one of the 20 fastest growing companies in the Tri-Counties. Armstrong Associates provides a broad range of building, consulting, and construction services for simple to elaborate commercial and residential projects. They specialize in green building construction, and they excel at assisting architectural firms with timely, cost-efficient design and budget criteria, while working closely with clients, government agencies, and the general public to ensure quality from start to finish. Looking for a general contractor who is dedicated to exceeding desires and expectations, contact Bill Shields at Armstrong Associates 569-6170 or armassoc.com.
You have a message that others can benefit from. A meditation to share. A talk to give that you want heard by more than just those present. A workshop, seminar, presentation with speakers whose information, insight, and inspiration can help others to break through to their highest potential and purpose. Making a quality recording is the first step to making it available, and fast forward is the right direction. They'll bring the recording studio to you. Your message is important. It needs to be recorded by professionals who share your passion and want to provide quality recording to those who want and need to hear it. Call 805-708-9804 to take that first step. 805-708-9804. Call Fast Forward for all your recording needs on location and in studio. 805-708-9804.
Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us every Saturday. We're talking today with the author of Brainstorm. His name is Eric Maisel. He is a PhD, and am I correct, this is your wife, Anne, who joins you in the collaboration?
That's right. My wife just retired after 35 years in a private high school, and she got to obsess about obsessions and do the research on this book, so we had a lot of fun.
Well, and that's wonderful, because a lot of times, projects with husbands and wives working on them together, especially something like this, can be very stressful. But I tell you what, when you can do things, and I know my wife and I are the same way, when we are working, say, out in the yard, working in the garden, what have you, we just have the greatest time. And 95% of the time, I usually defer to her as far as, okay, well, where do you want this, and how deep do you want it, and so on and so forth. She just has a sixth sense about where things are supposed to go, mm-hmm. and what have you.
And collaborations are tricky.
Yeah.
I've done several of them, and they've worked out really well, but I also have many clients who've entered into collaborations, and they haven't worked out that well. So they are tricky.
Well, let's talk about brainstorms. They sound pretty tricky as well. What is it that brings on a brainstorm? Or maybe the better question is, what is a brainstorm?
In technical language, there are lots of neurons gathering, neuronal gestalts gathering and staying together for a long time. To say that simply, every thought requires neurons gathering. That's what a thought is. Maybe it's 10 million neuron gathering or 100 million neurons gathering. That's what a thought is. When you're having a bigger thought, you're using more of your neurons, and if you're obsessing about something, they're staying together for a longer amount of time. You're thinking about the thing longer. So that's what I'm calling a brainstorm, is using more of your brain, having more of your brain's neurons gathering, and having them stay together for a longer amount of time. That's a very simple way of saying a complicated thing, because the real complexity looks like the following. A young Beethoven might hear a tune, a folk tune, and 30 years later, he turns it into a symphony. He's never heard it again. He's never heard it subsequently. But it's been held somewhere and worked on somewhere. And that's what the brain can do. It's really an amazing organ. That's what the brain can do. It can think about something 30 years ago and keep thinking about it somewhere and end up with a book or a theory or a symphony. So that's the sort of thing I'm talking about, this amazing facility of the brain to use its neurons to hold on to thoughts for a long time.
But you're talking about harnessing, as you say in the subtitle, harnessing the power of productive obsessions when it comes to brainstorming. So I would venture that you're not talking about musing for days, weeks, months, or years over that 30-year-old memory per se.
No, not per se. I'm meaning lots of different things. It could be just elevating a hobby into something more than a hobby by paying extra attention to it. It could be attacking a personal problem from a direction other than impulsivity and anxiety, actually thinking it through. What we're really talking about is sustained thinking of one sort or another. And we give lots of examples in the book of contemporary productive obsessions, just to give people a flavor of what we're talking about, not just famous historical ones like, you know, Einstein looking for unified field theory, but very simple ones, simple to talk about. For instance, we talk about one woman who just became obsessed with not wanting books that were printed on paper with acid in them to dissolve and disintegrate, and she started a one-woman campaign for acid-free paper, which nowadays most publishers will use. So we're talking about that kind of intensity, often even activism, because if you're so interested in something, often it'll force you to do something in the world about it. That kind of energy and enthusiasm, passion, interest, those are the sorts of things we're talking about.
Well, when we talk here on this program about new paradigms and taking a look at all of the different possibilities that are out there, it sounds to me like you've come up with a way for us to maybe better utilize those neurons, if you will.
That's right.
And put them to a use that is not just productive, to coin the word from your book, but also that has purpose, it has meaning, it has intent, it has all of the things that a lot of the creative and motivational speakers are speaking about today to, as we say, create a new world.
Exactly. I think our unproductive obsessions arise pretty much unbidden from anxiety, whether it's, you know, an unproductive obsession about what our coworker said to us 3 days ago and we're still brooding about that, or whether it's those hand-washing obsessions that people know about, or whether it's certain phobias. All of those things arise pretty much unbidden. We don't want them. Productive obsessions can be, they're not always, but they can be quite intentional, quite in line with serving our meaning-making needs, and we make decisions about them. We make choices. Yes, I'd like to have this obsession. Writing a novel for 2 years is a productive obsession. It's a choice. It doesn't just happen. You have to sit there through thick and thin and do it. So I entirely agree that it's a way of talking about intentionality and brain functionality and how to marry the two ideas of how the brain wants to work with what our intentions are for our lives.
I interviewed a gentleman about 25 years ago. He wrote a book, I think the title was Brain Power, How to Utilize the Other 90% of Our Brains.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you in that context, are we only using 10%, or are we just not able to measure the fact that we are using 80 or 90 or 95% of our brains?
I would say it slightly differently, because I don't really know about brain percentages, and I'm not sure we'll ever be able to figure out how that works. What I think is going on is that we're thinking far too many small thoughts all the time. If you buy the idea that every thought steals neurons or costs neurons or involves neurons, which I think is absolutely true, then you have to agree that the more small thoughts we have, the more neurons we're stealing from our finite number. So if all day long we're thinking, I have to pick up the kids at 3, and does the lawn need mowing, and what's for dinner, and one thing after another, if we're thinking one thought like that after another, we can't possibly be having enough neurons left to have big thoughts. That's why the first step in having a productive obsession is quieting our minds and getting rid of thoughts that don't serve us. So we can't just leap into, let's choose a productive obsession and go there. The first step is retrieving, reclaiming our neurons from all the small things we're thinking all day long. And a ton of those small things are our responsibilities and what have you. We can't really just get rid of them. That's why we suggest in the book that you maintain your productive obsession for just a portion of the day. At least try to quiet your mind for an hour or two. Have some big ideas arise in that hour or two. I think it's too much to ask to imagine that we can quiet our mind all day long. We just have too many things on our mind to do that. But I do think we can quiet our mind for an hour or two, retrieve neurons for that amount of time, and discover that we have many more neurons than we understood we had.
And it's said that the difference between one who puts into action and creates a millionaire status from a quote-unquote millionaire idea, and everyone else is that he put it into action. All of us, they say, have maybe 10 to 20 million dollar ideas every day if we spent that time, you know, thinking and musing and what have you. We all have them, but most of us don't do anything about them.
That's right. I mean, in therapy, the analogy in therapy is every therapist knows there's insight and then there's work. It isn't really enough for a client or patient to get an insight into what his problem is. He then has to do the work to make changes or whatever's necessary. Absolutely. I'm talking a lot about elaborating ideas. Our daughters, when they were growing up, I would drive them to school, and they were aware that at any moment I might drive off to the side of the road and jot down an idea because I would take my own ideas seriously.
Oh.
And I think most people don't take their own ideas seriously. They have an idea which may be one of those million-dollar ideas you just mentioned, and it goes in one ear and out the other, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They don't take it seriously. They would never think of pulling out their little pad in the supermarket and jotting down a good idea. They'd feel conspicuous, they'd feel silly, they'd be embarrassed. Most people don't know how to take their own ideas seriously, and as a consequence, they let their ideas come and go.
It's funny because they have no problem standing in line talking on the cell phone loudly or texting while walking down the street, not really watching what they're doing.
Exactly.
Which to me, when you run into the lamppost, that's a little more embarrassing than stopping and writing down in a little pad an idea
most
that you just had.
Most people would not agree. I mean, intellectually, they would agree. But viscerally, in their heart, they would much prefer to run into a lamp pole than to be caught having an idea and writing it down.
Yeah. That's extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not sure what to say to that. It boggles my mind.
Well, I think it comes from our training as children, as a species, both in the home and in the school, where we're supposed to know, you know, facts and dates and this. We really are not trained to think, and we're a little reprimanded for thinking because we have to get the tests right. You know, we have to get the answers right for the tests.
And rote memorization.
Rote memorization and very, very narrow, confined thinking. And I think one notices in schools that if you try to invite students at any grade, whether it's third grade or PhD level, to really think about something, their comeback is it on the test? What do I really have to know? You know, what are the requirements of this class? That kind of response.
Yeah.
Not, wow, thanks for giving me the opportunity to think. Students really, they get very nervous when invited to think.
Now, you're a creativity coach. Have you been doing this all of your life? What are some of the other areas?
Well, I've had maybe three large journeys. I started out as a novelist, then I segued into therapy. I'm a licensed family therapist, and I worked exclusively with creative performing artists as a therapist. Then I didn't much like the medical model or the naming of ailments and sorts of things that we've been talking about off the air.
Mm-hmm.
And so I moved from being a therapist to being a coach, and I've done that for maybe 20 years now.
I find it interesting because we were talking off the air about work that you have right now and dealing with the issue of depression, and I found it fascinating when I learned that anger was just, or that depression was just anger turned inward. And I'm thinking, but I'm not angry. I'm a little down. I'm a little sad. I wish that it were colder or warmer, or I wish that it were greener or yellower, or I wish that it were other than what it is, in relationship, in job, in situation, and I'm just not, you know, I'm just not there. I've never been able to say, how is that angry, you know?
That's right.
But again, it's labels.
The whole question of what depression is just more complicated than people have time to understand. And, you know, the easy way out, it's not that it isn't useful, but the easy way out is to say, wow, a pill, how great.
Yeah.
That is the easy way out. And as I say, it can be very useful if you're in the depths of something and the pill has an effect that gets you out of those depths. Obviously, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But our conversation about depression is pretty darn shallow, and I'm hoping that we can, you know, as a society, talk about it in more sophisticated ways.
And change the energetics about the word,
or
come up with a new word to describe the myriad of emotions that it really is, because each person's a little different. And I, by the way, I'd been musing about this over the years. The baby boomers, of course, who grew up primarily in the 60s and 70s and knew the drug culture and so forth, are running the drug companies now. And it brings to mind the song, One Pill Makes You Larger and One Pill Makes You Small. And I'm thinking, and guess who's running the drug companies today?
Well, we know the world is really like Alice in Wonderland, so there's nothing so surprising about that.
This is true. This is true.
Eat me, drink me, etc.
Exactly right. My guest today is the author of Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions, Eric Maisel, and his wife co-authored with him on this work. And it's very interesting because it is true that a mind is a terrible thing to waste, and yet that is exactly what we do when we spend our weekends and our neurons, as Eric said earlier, reliving a workplace squabble and also spending a family visit chewing over childhood holidays. That, when I read that, I thought, yep, holidays right there. That's what he's talking about. But I have to say that I have never had those kinds of experiences with my family. I guess I grew up in a pretty good family where we dealt pretty well with a lot of the issues, and we didn't get bogged down in a lot of stuff and didn't carry it forward into our adulthood saying, look, this is the way that I am, and it's not your fault.
You must be from another planet.
Well, I've learned over the years to try as much as I can to take personal responsibility for who and what I am. That, yes, I may have been influenced by outside forces, but I chose to act or react how I chose to act or react. And reacting, of course, would be based upon, you know, previous experiences and so on and so forth. And I'm learning how to change that from reacting to saying, you know what, I'm not going to respond that way this time.
Yep.
Because this is this time. This isn't that time. This is new. This is brand new. This is now. That's what we're trying to encourage our listeners to
Absolutely.
Do, too.
Absolutely. In a lot of families, it's hard to do that, though, because our sisters and brothers and parents and children are superb at getting under our skin.
Yeah, they're button pushers.
They're button pushers. They know every button. They know the buttons that we can't see. So our resolutions as we're driving to Thanksgiving, you know, that they're really hard to maintain them even through the hors d'oeuvres.
And then, of course, if some families happen to imbibe in the wine or the beer, what have you, it creates a whole new dynamic.
Yeah, it becomes very convenient as a way to loosen your tongue and not have to take responsibility for what you said afterwards. Yeah, it's wonderful.
And that was the beer talking.
That was the beer talking. I didn't say you were fat.
You just heard that. That came out of the can. This is extraordinary as well, because one of the other books that, as I was going through the list of books, not only in the book Brainstorm in the back of the book, but also on your website, I came across a book that really intrigued me, though I have not read it, just the title alone, which lends a little insight into where you're coming from. You wrote the book The Atheist Way.
I did indeed.
Which implies, of course, or maybe says quite outright, that you are an atheist.
I am indeed.
And I'm curious because, in spite of the fact that I grew up in my career within a Christian radio station, and I was told what Madeline Murray O'Hare believed by these people, I really don't know. I really don't know what it is that, and I know that an agnostic, as it has been described, is one who would say, as far as God would be concerned, I don't know. What does an atheist say? In regards to God and spirituality?
I don't know what all atheists say. I can tell you what I say.
Okay.
I believe that all gods that I can see written about seem to me clearly the inventions of human beings. They just seem to have the qualities and characteristics of human beings, and they seem to me to have been created whole cloth out of the human imagination. And if there are big mysteries, they are mysteries. And if you tell me you know something about that big mystery, I don't believe you, because I just don't believe that you can have some better insight into something that's a genuine mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Belief seems to be an easy way to change the game from genuine mystery to, gee, that's not a real mystery, I know exactly what's going on.
Mm.
And I don't feel like that's true. I don't feel like people have an understanding of the answers of true mystery.
Is there a difference between, in your mind, between God and spirituality?
It's a really interesting question. I'm certainly more against in quotation marks, I'm more against a bearded God than I am a kind of generic feeling about the oneness of the universe. However, I think that all spiritual language is a little dangerous and kind of a betrayal of our common humanity. That's my personal belief system. Because when you start to say, you know, the Andes are really okay mountains, but the Himalayas are much more spiritual. When you start to use language like that, I think you start to disrespect whatever's on the other side of that equation. Things, you know, your garden becomes spiritual, but your cubicle isn't.
Hmm.
And those kinds of distinctions seem to me to be partly, you know, wish fulfillment, partly aesthetic about your garden being prettier than your cubicle. All sorts of things are going on with spiritual language that I don't think has anything to do with, to make a strange statement, genuine spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have as much trouble with spiritual language as with pure God language, but I think it's troublesome. And from my point of view, I would say it's something for people to avoid.
And I would try to bring this full circle by then asking in regards to, say, intuition or that sixth sense, that is something that you would encourage, though you may not call it that, you would encourage your students, those who you teach and coach, to tap into.
Absolutely. I though, would say that that's making a distinction which I try to help my clients and students not make, namely, wherever there are dualities, we start to get into opposition, whether it's between, let's say, intuition and logic. I would advise my clients that both are available to them, and that, like, if you know your Taoism, you know that yin and yang is not about being feminine or masculine. It's about having all of those qualities available to you and then choosing in a given situation how you want to be. I think the same is true with something like a pair like intuition and logic. Have them both available to you, and then whatever is the way to go at a given moment, that's the way to go. But I wouldn't start to elevate one above another. There are all sorts of people who would elevate logic above intuition, and all sorts of people who would elevate intuition above logic. I think both are viable ways of knowing, and we should embrace both of them and arrive at our personal understanding of how we want to, so to speak, balance the two ways of knowing.
I think that's extraordinary. There was even a conversation I had with someone you may be familiar with, Greg Braden. He had written a book called The Spontaneous Healing of Belief. And this kind of delves into a little bit of what we're talking about here, in that the description was the difference between belief as he saw it. He wanted to reach a new place of knowing, that we would start dropping off old belief systems and old things that we believed for a genuine, not guessing, not, as you kind of described it, the spiritual knowing, and hey, I know about this mystery, but that we genuinely know. I mean, we really do know and understand this aspect, because science has been able to help us to understand and know this concept or this principle.
I certainly understand what you're saying. I don't think I agree with his thesis. I think we can't know. I don't think we can penetrate the mystery. I think what we can do is decide to make personal meaning and make meaning investments every day.
Mm.
Make decisions about how we're going to represent ourselves and make ourselves proud, how we're going to sustain our interests and be good people. I think we can make decisions every day, and that amounts to making meaning, in my language.
And I have to speculate, too, Eric, that sometimes people will pose certain questions that really they're trying to pass judgment on the one they're asking the question of, and the question really shouldn't be asked. And the one that comes to my mind is, so do you think that this was all, that this existence that we live was an accident? And my understanding from our conversation thus far is that that's an irrelevant question because you already believe that there is meaning to life. It doesn't matter whether it is or isn't an accident or whether it was or wasn't on purpose. We're here and there's something within each one of us that says, there's meaning in my life, and I want to pursue that.
I entirely agree. That was a long sentence, and there was one little phrase in there that I would dispute about meaning of life. I think there's only subjective meaning.
Okay.
We make decisions about meaning. You know, if four people are driving along the road, and they see a tree, and if for one person, it's a tree he wants to run the car into because he's feeling suicidal, and another person carved his initials in that tree years ago, and it's a sentimental thing, and another person is a botanist. Everybody, for that tree is meaningful in different ways to those people. And I don't think that there's any way to really, if you think it through, imagine objective meaning. I think there are only subjective meaning choices.
That's what I've come to learn in my short, 50 years on this planet, that everything that I experience and then express in whatever way I express it is subjective because it's coming through my filters.
That's exactly right. And naturally, the next argument against that position is, well, then, to quote, you know, the Dostoevsky line, then everything is permitted. And isn't that true, that then everything is permitted? And we could go down the line of conversing about that. But I would still stand behind the idea that there is only subjective meaning. There can't be objective meaning. It can't be objectively meaningful whether we go to Mars or don't go to Mars. That's only about who gets to decide.
Yeah.
And almost anything you could name, it can't be objectively meaningful. It's only about what individuals believe about that thing.
Well, and I always used to take that sort of tack when I would talk with people, you know, especially at the religious station, the Christian station, about the Bible. And I said, well, wait a minute. You're telling me that so-and-so has drawn the line in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
But I come back to you and say, who decided that that person was going to draw the line?
Yeah, and how is it that I got a stick to draw my own line?
Exactly.
Who gave me that stick to draw my own line?
That's right. So I think that, and I want to kind of go back to something else that you said earlier. I thought it was real interesting in light of what we're talking about here. You know, you teach people to tap into that creativity, to tap into the, let's say, that million-dollar idea. But you also said that we lack the training, both the patience we have patterns in our lives that we do every day, a routine. I can't think of the word I want to use. But we also lack the education. In other words, if I came up with this image in my head that I didn't understand, in other words, I couldn't make heads or tails of it, I wouldn't do anything with it.
You wouldn't do anything with it. That's exactly right.
And so discipline. That was the word. We don't have the discipline or the education to convert those ideas.
I would like to move the discipline word slightly. I agree. But Pavarotti had a quote I really like, which is, people say I'm disciplined, but it's not discipline, it's devotion, and there's a big difference.
Ah.
I think we need to talk less about discipline and more about devotion in life, because if you had, let's say, that idea that you know interests you but you're about to throw away, it's not so much that you need discipline to sit down and follow through on it. It's rather you need devotion to your own meaning-making understanding, devotion to your own pride, devotion to yourself. It's really about self-love in a certain sense and love of life. To go do something with that idea.
Well, you raise another thought, and that is that I've heard it said that when I go work for a company, if let's say I'm applying for
exactly.
a job, that I need to catch their vision. I can never catch their vision because it's theirs.
Exactly.
I can get an understanding in a minute way of what it is, but it will never be mine.
Exactly.
I might have the devotion, the sense of purpose to pursue a particular pathway in my life that might run parallel to, in sync with this company, and wonderful, then we're a match made in heaven, so
exactly.
to speak.
Exactly. But otherwise, you're just going to have to use discipline. That's really a good distinction, because often when we work for others, it's discipline we have to manifest. When we work for ourselves, it's devotion we have to manifest. We need to figure out what we love. Part of the idea of productive obsessions is the idea of passion, enthusiasm, interest, curiosity, all of those words.
Mm.
Most people have only mere interests. They don't have genuine interests. They're actually too busy to know what they're even interested in. When they were kids, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, they knew they loved movies or loved books or loved music or loved nature, loved science. We had pure loves as kids. Going to that darkened movie theater, all of those things, those were such simple, genuine, pure loves. As adults, we've lived too many years, we've been so busy surviving, that for most people, they don't really know what genuinely interests them anymore. One of the steps of coming up with a productive obsession is to generate a list of your interests and see what's on that list, see what wants to rise to the level of obsession.
Mm.
And for a lot of people, that's a hard step to know what even interests them.
Yeah. You know, my wife and I were traveling around today to different places, and she collects glass bowls and cups and jars and bottles and so forth.
Oh, and my wife makes them, so they should have a conversation.
Well, we'll put them in touch, because here's what she does. She will then take those items, and she uses marine glue,
mm-hmm.
and she will then glue them together in a vertical, I'll call them pagoda, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And she's actually going to design one out there, out in front of our home where we live, next to the Kuan Lin statue. And what's extraordinary, and I thought of this when you talked to, when we were just discussing the difference between discipline and devotion and vision, I like what she creates,
mm-hmm.
but I don't have her vision. She has her vision.
Exactly.
And when she creates it, I like it because I like the fact that she's working all these different shapes and sizes and colors.
That's right.
And it fascinates me from that standpoint, but it's not really something I want to do.
No. And your job, so to speak, is to let her do it.
Yeah.
That's what our jobs are with, if we have creative mates, and hopefully we're creative ourselves. We have to allow people to do the things they want to do. We have
and
to
even encourage them.
Encourage them, give them solitude, enter into real agreements where if they need 7 to 9 in the morning, we shouldn't need our mates 24 hours a day unless we're on the floor bleeding. But otherwise, we should be able to do our own thing some percentage of the time. An awful lot of my clients have basic problems with articulating contracts with their family members such that they can get even a little solitude out of their day, and that's a shame.
I think that's an interesting distinction, because most people might think that in a couple, a relationship, that to be separated for any length of time is a bad thing. And in reality, it is a good thing, because when you come back to the relationship, if you will, in a physical sense, you bring with you that which you gained from your solitude.
Absolutely, but even if you brought back nothing except your usual self, even if you brought back nothing, you're still entitled
mm-hmm.
to have your creative life.
Yeah.
Because it's the way it's one of our most important meaning-making activities. If you steal from somebody their ability to create, you've reduced their ability to have a meaningful life. And why would you want to do that to the
right.
person you claim to love? So, yes, it's true. It's in fact true that we do come back with renewed energy and mm. things to talk about and what have you. But even if we didn't, we'd be entitled to those 2 hours of solitude each day.
Now, you've written a number of books in the last 40 years, and I'm curious, because I don't have them in front of me to know this, none of them are real epics like War and Peace. What was the general length of time that you took to write some of these books?
If I had to, off the top of my head, give a sense of general time, I'd say 6 to 8 months.
But
I think that's a normal, sort of an average time mm-hmm. for writing a book for me.
But that wasn't necessarily a straight solitude in a cave somewhere writing. It was obviously in that...
No, it was straight, but not in a cave. I mean, I write 7 days a week. I go to
okay.
my computer at 5 in the morning, and I write every day. I have a book coming out in 2011, a book coming out in 2012, and another book that's looking for a publisher that should be my 2013 book. So, yeah, I write every day. I don't write on the road. I mean, we go on long vacations sometimes, mm-hmm. and I can take long breaks from it. But just as a general rule, that is my practice, just as one has, to use the language we were using previously, a spiritual practice. I have my writing practice. I have that. I do that every day.
And it's a devotion to you, not
right.
a discipline.
Exactly. If you made me do it, I wouldn't do it. I'm as stubborn as the next person, you know, as ornery. If it was something that I was doing out of discipline, I wouldn't do it.
Interesting. And so if you're in the area in the near future, please stop in to Santa Barbara. We'd love to have you in studio to talk face-to-face. It'd be wonderful. But the other thing I wanted to ask you in light of the fact that you've just stated that you are in the process, not quite as we speak, of writing three books at the same time.
Well,
how have you disciplined yourself?
I don't really do that. I think maybe I said that in a way that was a little confusing. Two of them are written.
Ah.
You know, I write them serially. I can juggle two books sometimes, but basically I'm a one book at a time guy.
Okay.
I think that's almost necessary because I think as we're talking about how neurons work, if your neurons are loosening their grip from thoughts you don't need and trying to gather around the thoughts you do want, you only want them thinking about one big obsession at a time.
And my boss and I have gotten into a conversation over the last few weeks in regards to multitasking. And, of course, we're both very much aware of the report that came out just recently about the downside of multitasking, that all of the tasks that are being handled by the multitasker are inferior. But we've come up with a new phrase here that from now on, all we will do is serial single tasking.
Exactly.
That's all we do.
That's exactly right. And I try to help my clients understand, A, that they want a morning creativity practice, as we talked about earlier, but also that among their serial tasks is that if they see 15 minutes looming on the horizon that are, so to speak, free, or half an hour that's, so to speak, free, that they can turn to their actual real work in that half hour. Almost no one does.
Mm-hmm.
They check their email. They eat a power bar. They do something for those 15 minutes and then move on to their next task. But those can be enormously productive little chunks of time once you learn how to quickly transition from whatever you were just doing to your creative work.
You know, it is extraordinary to think about this, and I want to ask you in light of this issue of serial single-tasking versus multitasking,
mm-hmm.
how has our technology helped us and or hurt us in the aspects of creativity and productive obsessions?
You know, that's such a question that I don't even know where to get started. Seriously, I mean, I think there are probably 5 trillion upsides and 5 trillion downsides. For me, just personally, for me as a writer, the technology is superb. I could hardly live without it now. If I'm doing a book and I need to know the definition of a word in an instant, or more than the definition of a word, if I'm writing about a concept and I wonder what 30 other people have written about it, I can do that in a split second. I can find that. Just moving away from carbon paper, I don't know if there's anyone listening who's ever had the experience of using carbon paper or typing or whiteout or any of those things. I mean, I come from a tradition where, you know, if you change 3 words in a book, you redid the manuscript. So for me personally, I know there are tremendous downsides to where we are technologically, but for me there's a tremendous upside.
So in one aspect, if you tried to look at technology from an objective perspective, which we've already concluded you can't do, but needless to say, as objective
That's
as
right.
possible, you would see that there are the pluses. You'd see the pluses and the minuses.
I would certainly
have to live with
the pluses.
Them.
I certainly would not go to the place of it's a complete horror. I would certainly not go to that place.
Well, I was nearly run into by a young gal who was texting while walking down State Street the other day. That's the downside for me. Thank you, technology. But by the same token, here we are, and we're conversing, and we're on the internet as well, streaming live.
Exactly.
And it's quite phenomenal.
I do also think, I'm not precisely a conspiracy theorist, but but I do think that, you know, often people of power do gather together and do things that we're not so happy about. I do think technology allows the little guy and the little gal to have a voice. As long as we can all speak on the internet, I do think that's kind of a wonderful thing.
Well, I'm quite encouraged by what you have to share in Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions, and we're going to continue, or I guess in a better vernacular, is we're going to wrap up the program as soon as we come back from this break. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Duke, and stay tuned.
Remember the stories your family used to tell?
July got married, 1913, when my father and my uncle came from Italy.
When was the last time you listened to the songs of your youth?
Very swinging sound here in the Bilhart Underground. That's Wild Things.
Want to hear those voices and music again? Fast Forward can help. Fast Forward Audio Communications can transfer your records and tapes to CD so you can hear them again for the first time.
You're listening to a live transmission of the voice of astronaut Walter Chirac.
Those memories are priceless and are great to hand down to the next generation. Keep those memories alive. Call 805-708-9804.
That's the greatest thing that I ever heard.
Fast Forward. It's the right direction for preserving your family memories. Just call 805-708-9804.
When it's time to clean your carpets, you should know that some carpet cleaners can leave harmful toxins in your home or office. That's why Wallace Cleaning Company created the four-step cleaning process that uses state-of-the-art equipment and environmentally safe, non-toxic solutions to clean your carpets with your satisfaction guaranteed and your safety in mind. Since 1979, Wallace Cleaning Company has been the Santa Barbara area's premier choice for quick, quiet, efficient, and safe carpet cleaning that dries in 2 hours or less. When it's time to clean your carpets at home or office, it's time to call a name you can trust at a price you can afford. It's time to call 967-1860 to talk to the pros at Wallace Cleaning Company, where no job is too big or too small. Wallace Cleaning Company, 967-1860. Learn more about the affordable four-step cleaning process that cleans your carpets with your safety in mind.
If we leave here today, we could be 1,000 miles away. Take to that road, see how far it goes, and on that great ocean road, all the country's in our bones, all the trouble. You know, empties out as you go. Oh, walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories.
And we're here walking and talking with Dr. Eric Maisel. He is the author of Brainstorm and many other books as well that you can find on your website, which is, Doctor, what is your website?
EricMaisel.com, and that's EricMaisel.com. There's also a website for the book specifically, and that's brainstormthebook.com.
And then I think gets you back to your other website as well. So
yep.
Lots of good information that folks can look at and check out and ponder and muse and have a lot of fun with, too. I remember taking a test, it was about 15, 20 years ago. It may have been with that one book I mentioned before about brain power or what have you. It had these little tests in it. And the first one was that they put together a series of numbers, and I can even throw them out. There's like a 3, a 4, a 9, a 7, a 2, and a 1, that's just for sake of argument. Mm-hmm. And it was said, find the pattern. And I looked and I looked and I found it. And it was the fact that every other character was straight lines.
Mm-hmm.
And every other character
right.
was curved lines.
It was
lines.
A visual one. It was
right.
a trick.
Right. But then, second one, so I got that one, and mm-hmm. I threw all of that out. I said, oh, great, I figured it out. Next one was letters, and it said to find the pattern, and it was B, A, M, Q, V, S, and so forth. And I pondered that thing for 15 minutes, and I could not, for the mm-hmm. life of me, find the answer.
Mm-hmm.
The answer was the same as the first question.
That's funny, isn't it?
And so I wonder, how do we, using those wonderful neurons in our brains to creatively create, how do we use those same neurons to solve problems without throwing out the baby with the bathwater?
It's really an interesting question. Every educator pays lip service to the idea that critical thinking needs to be taught in the schools, and yet study after study indicates that no critical thinking is actually taught in the schools. I think if we helped students understand argument forms, what criteria of evaluation mean, all kinds of technical language said simply so that people would understand what makes for problem solving, I think we'd all do a better job of, you know, getting those kinds of questions right, but also understanding how to deal with the big questions, which are not so much answerable, but which need to be thought about if we're to be, you know, intelligent, useful human beings.
Yeah, well, that's what we try to encourage here. Before we wrap up the program, I have a question for you that I ask all of my guests. It's the end of the program, and it's always interesting the answers that we get. But again, there's never any right or wrong answer. This is not a test. But you could have been doing many, many other things. And yet here you are, you're a creative coach as well as a multi-book author and so forth, and quite insightful as well. Why this? Why now?
It's such a long journey to get right here that it's really hard to answer that. But all the things I do interest me, whereas things that I started out doing, I started out first in science and physics, math and physics, and then in philosophy, they didn't interest me. So the short answer may be that I've collected a number of pursuits that continue to interest me and that sustain me, and I've done a lot of other things that don't interest me, and I kind of know the difference.
Mm. And you're certainly devoted to the things that you're doing today.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows what you'll be doing tomorrow.
That's right.
And that's the fun of this life. It's a great joy. Again, I encourage you that if you are in the area, you and your wife are in the area of Santa Barbara, please look us up. I'd love to have you come into town and sit down and talk further face-to-face on these subjects.
That'd be great.
It's just extraordinary, and I thank you so much for your time and your book, Brainstorm. Again, that is also the website. It's brainstorm.com.
No, it's brainstormthebook.com.
The book. Brainstormthebook.com. Again, that's Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions, again, by both Eric and his wife, Ann Maisel. And it's available at his website, as we've mentioned. It's an owner's manual for your brain. When was the last time you were able to say that? You know, I can get an owner's manual for my computer and my portable drive or my push mower or any other appliance or device that I might buy, but it's kind of neat to be able to say, here's the manual. Okay, and let's see. I'm having problem downloading data. Okay, go to chapter 13, and we should be able to help you there. Again, Dr. Maisel, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We encourage you to go to our website, richarddugan.com. Check out the archives that we have posted there. This program will be posted shortly after the broadcast. We'll have a link to Dr. Maisel's website, and you'll be able to check out all of the books that he has available and see what you think. And let him know. Email him as well. And we encourage you to email us. My email address, richard@richarddugan.com. I mean, how much easier can it be than richard@richarddugan.com? And, of course, check out all of the programs that we have been producing and putting on the air for almost 3 years, if you can believe that. Well, until next Saturday at this same time, 3 p.m. Pacific time, streaming live on the Internet, I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Again, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next Saturday at this same time, love.